We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
Man, I'll tell you, freaking day one, I don't know, you guys had the same transition, but like, I believe it was probably like a Wednesday or something. I moved from patrol to SCAT. And the SCAT stands for Special Crimes Apprehension Team. And what was crazy was I didn't realize there was a transition from being a cop, like a beat cop wearing your uniform, fully marked police car. You have all the lights and sirens to the day that you are not. So I get in there, they give me all my gear, and we get this hot tone. This dude's robbing a bank in downtown Mesa. And so our team starts taking off. I'm riding with my sergeant and the brand new guy. So both of us, we're in a minivan and we're in the back seat. So you know these minivans have dual open doors, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is now, remember, this is day one, dude. So long story, the guy goes in into a hotel and backs in. And we get there a little bit after he backs in, his trunk's open, he's getting the money, he supposedly robbed the bank at gunpoint, he's going into his hotel room, and our sergeant's like, okay, we're the only ones here, there's three of us, two of them. If he comes back out and opens his trunk, we're going to come up and go nose to nose. Brock, you're going to the left, Chris, you're going to the right, and you guys are going to get out. And remember, man, like yesterday, I'm in a fully full-mark police uniform. Today, I look like a cop out of uniform. I don't have the hair yet. I don't have earrings. I got nothing, dude. And lo and behold, this cat comes out of his hotel room and pops open the trunk and starts loading these bags. And our sergeant drives up, gets close to it, doors fling open. And right then, I'm like, what do I do? I'm thinking, shit, dude, like, do you badge him? I didn't have a badge, nothing, dude. I wasn't prepared. So the dude sees us coming. We're coming around this corner of this car. He looks to the left, and Chris is about 6'4". I'm 6'1". He's like, I'm going to take the little guy. He turns, and I'm already suplexed in the air because I'm like, I don't have a gun, dude. I mean, I have a gun, but I'm not having time to draw everything out. So I whack this dude as hard as I think I've ever hit anybody, knock him down, we handcuff him. And all I'm thinking now is, I'm getting fired, dude. I just like fully assaulted this dude. I didn't identify myself as a cop. I didn't say a damn thing. And I waxed him. I hit him so hard, right? And I get back in the car, I'm just like, up in the van, I'm like, I'm fired, dude. They're like, he's gonna drive me to the police station and fire me. And I'm like, I'm like tore up inside, right? And one of our SWAT guys was on scene watching it from above, and he gets on the radio and goes, hey, Scott 64. And I'm like, dude, I'm not responding, dude. I'm not saying this is day one. I'm not getting on the SCAT radio. Hey, SCAT 64. I'm like, no, radio silence. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And he's like, hey, SCAT 64, you gonna answer me? And I'm like, oh. And my sergeant's looking at me. Everybody's looking at me. I'm thinking I'm gone, dude. Like, I just lost my career. And he's like, hey, SCAT 64, that was a nice shot. And then click. And I'm like, oh, all I'm thinking about is I'm getting fired. You know, yeah, transitions, it's dirty, dude. It's different.
Yeah.
Welcome to the unit, right?
Yeah. And it was like,
you passed the test, man.
yeah. So it worked out for me. So that was day one. Dude, and I kind of so just jumped awesome. In. I loved it, man.
Yep. It doesn't get any better than that. And then you have a million more stories like that, which makes it that much cooler, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool.
It just went up from there.
Yeah. Yeah. That transition is awkward though.
Well, there's nothing that says, there's no kind of like training or anything that says you're going from a patrol unit to a specialized unit like that, like or a street crimes unit, whatever. It's just like one day you're plucked, and like you said, you show up with clean shave, haircut. You know, you don't look the cool part yet. You know, you haven't grown out the beard or the hair or whatever. And then you just jump in a van, and all of a sudden you're trying to catch up with everybody, and they're moving 90 miles an hour, right? Hey,
dude, your hair's on fire, dude.
Yeah, and at least I thought you were going to tell us the punchline of the story was the guy that you tackled was actually the CI or the informant who was doing some type of undercover work or something, and no one told you, you know.
man, we did a buy bust on the DEA.
Mm-hmm.
Like we had blue on blue one time where we're building these cases. You know how it is. You're building cases, and dude, we're selling dope. We're buying dope, but it's like this is amazing, right? These guys want to keep upping their dope, and we're flashing millions of dollars briefcase flashing. And the next thing you know, dude, we do a buy bust on them. They jump out with freaking DEA vest. We jump out with scat vest. It's like, dude, we're doing buy bust on cops, dude.
Oh, that's terrible.
So I get what you're saying.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Well, hey, I want to introduce everybody to Brock Bevel, the guy you hear talking, telling this story. And we're going to get into a lot of stuff. He and I met through Instagram. You hear us always talking about the power of Instagram and just reaching out to people. And we just kind of crossed paths. We started messaging back and forth. You hear him talking. He's got the same vibe we do. It's just trying to help people get motivated. And we started talking, and then I learned that he had a podcast, or a broadcast, as our boy Jimmy calls it. So if you can, man, just right off the bat, tell us a little bit about your podcast, man, and what you got going on.
Yeah, that's cool, brother. Thanks for letting me share that. It's a podcast called Chase the Base. I started about 2 years ago on a whim. I'm just like, dude, I got to share some of these stories. I want to talk recovery with people. I want people to know that recovery is possible. We're seeing all this death and gloom and shit, right? All over the place. And I'm like, man, there's people out there that are living above that. And so my goal was, hey, let's tell some stories. And along the way, let's see if we can help people recover. And that was my mission. And it hasn't changed in 2 years. So I'm on like season 3, episode 35 or something. So I don't know, 135 episodes into it, which for me is a therapy session for myself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. Like I said, when we've talked, and it's one of those things where we start going down that path and getting kind of serious about when we talk about people that get addicted. And, you know, the stereotype is often, oh, well, it's always, you know, this type of person, that type of person. People don't ever talk about when police officers, you know, get addicted to any type of substance. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's an interesting phenomenon right there. So you know my story, BC. I was run over. I was working a prostitute, a lady that was prostituting her daughter, ended up just running me over. So I sustained a major knee injury. And of course, what do? Man, you got to go get surgery. You got to go checked on. And my doctor, he said something to me that I'll never forget. He goes, "Hey, Brock, listen, man, you're a cop. You'll never get hooked on these things, so you're good." And I remember going, dude, that was like carte blanche, man. Like, mm-hmm. I worked narcotics, dude, but I did not understand addiction like that. I didn't know, man. Mm-hmm. Right? I bought and sold dope. I've seen addicts. I've done the whole thing. I didn't realize the depth that you could go. I mean, we see homelessness. We see all that. But how drugs just like absolutely take your mind from you. And when my doctor said that, I didn't understand what my life was going to be like in 10 years after I was a full-blown opiate addict, right? So he looked at me as a cop, that you're not going to get addicted. And dude, it's not true.
And isn't it crazy that that was his perception? Like, he truly believed that too. He said it as a matter of fact is what it sounds like, right?
100%, man. That's what he believed.
Yeah.
And maybe he thought I had more self-control or whatever it was, but I didn't.
Well, I was going to say, I had a surgery probably less than about a year ago, year and a half ago, nothing major, but a lot of pain during the recovery. Surgeon offered Oxycontin. Now, I'd seen people get addicted, school teachers, other people, but it was the first thing that went through my mind was like, all right, I already know at least one person who has the same background as me, who has been through this, and I don't want to go through this. So I took the prescription, piece of paper, didn't say anything, went home, was like, no, I'm good. And I never got it filled, and I was in pain for like 3 or 4 days. I couldn't move. It was tough. When I went back to do the follow-up, the surgeon was like, what was your pain like? You know, trying to find out about the surgery. And I explained to her, like, yeah, I was in a lot of pain. And she said, well, how was the prescription? So I never filled it. I'm not going to feel it. Like I'm going to just deal with the pain as much as I can. I'm not saying I was in the most severe pain in my life, but I wasn't going to mess around with that, you know? So it's just one of those things that for me, knowing at every turn, like you just said, we sometimes think we're, you know, like some superhero or, oh, we've seen this, so we're not going to go down that path. But you look at how many people battle, you know, alcoholism, how many cops or anybody really in America who will battle alcoholism or now opioids, which, you know, you post daily almost, well, probably daily on fentanyl. And you and I have talked, you know, messages back and forth about the current trend of fentanyl and how it's being packaged and now it's being introduced. And probably, you name a drug, fentanyl's in it. Powder cocaine, people were overdosing on cocaine and they've got no idea what they're snorting. They think it's coke, you know. So you got this resurgence of coke being this like party drug, and now all of a sudden people are coding out and overdosing. And then when the families are notified and the friends are told that, they're like, no, that this isn't heroin, this was cocaine. We're like, yeah, but coke is getting stepped on with fentanyl. I think now even there's certain grades of weed somehow that's, you know, kind of almost like being laced like back in the day with PCP, but now it's being, you know, fentanyl's being injected, or not injected, but you know, introduced into that material. So where someone's smoking it now, oh, this dude's got, you know, something a little different than just the basic water, a little different than the hydro or high, you know, mid-grade, whatever. Now it's just a little step up. And now you're just starting to see that come in, you know, see it just packaged in. But I like how you always post stuff about it. And it's not just, you don't just post and say, hey, there's fentanyl killing people. You're pulling research. You're pulling like daily stats or messages, like powerful images that people can, you know, reshare or share and try to get the word out there, you know?
Yeah, man, I don't know about you guys in where you're at in the South, but Arizona's getting their asses kicked with fentanyl. We're losing people left and right. And Mike, you know, I don't know how the government can stop it. Mm-hmm. I know they're talking about opening the border, the Title 42. I know all that stuff, but my concern is we just sent $40 billion back to the Ukraine for the war. I get it. But I'm thinking, damn, dude, I don't know if it was like $114,000 we just spent on this monkeypox vaccine. Mm-hmm. And it's like, man, we're just throwing these millions and trillions and freaking billions of dollars at this stuff. And it's like, okay, when are we going to put money into something that really can? And I don't want to get political at all, because it's not the presidency. It's something that is affecting America. Mm-hmm. And every single person you know in your life know somebody that's in it or being affected by drugs right now.
Yeah. And the thing too, you would think that the fact that it's just like any drug, it permeates throughout any sociodemographics, any of that. But right now, just like we're talking, one out of three of us has been addicted, you know, just the three of us talking. And the three of us have, you know, just very similar backgrounds, just, you know. So then you would think that would kind of rise to the level of, oh, we need to pump more money into it. We need to do more to try to combat it, you know. So it's just one of those things that I'm right there with you, though.
Hey, let me ask you this. Have you ever taken opioids for pain before your incident?
I did. I had a surgery 2 years early. I was in a foot pursuit. This is kind of a funny story, man. It was a beer run. Dude stole two packs of 24 pack of beer, stopped him on the street.
The big case of the night.
Yeah. Here's the funny thing. This dude was African-American, and I faced a base with him, and I'm thinking, dude, if this dude runs, I'm not catching him. But he puts the beer down and takes off running. So I'm like, why not, dude? Why not chase him? Let's go. You know how our brains work. Mm-hmm. I got the beer. I could have taken it back, but I'm thinking, he committed a crime. Let's go. Mm-hmm. So he takes off. He takes me down a street. He goes to this fence, this wooden fence, and my man jumps the fence and is gone. Mm-hmm. Right? I jump the fence, and when I land, my foot gets – I land in a hole. I take the next step and blow my knee out. Okay. So I'm on one side of the fence down. Mm-hmm. My partner, Lance, bless his heart, he has died now. He goes, I got you, Bev. He goes to jump the fence, and the fence breaks on him. It's a wooden fence. Oh, he falls back and breaks there. His back. Oh. So he's on one side of the fence, dude, with a broken back. I'm on the other side of the fence with a blown out knee. And we're talking back and forth as the fence is falling on him. And the dude's gone.
All for a case of beer.
He's probably still running, though, I hope, man. But, yeah, so I had to go get surgery. And I remember the first time I took it, I'm like, ooh, wow, wait a minute. This kind of feels good. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I felt that chemical hook at that time. Because there's a big difference, and maybe I would really like to talk about this. When I was injured and when I was run over, I was retired. Okay? Okay. They tried to get me back to work. And so with that opioid came some depression, came some sadness, loss of team, isolation. I was pissed off, right? But the first time I knew I was getting back to work. So I was like, I got to get back to work. I got to get off this stuff. I got to go. And so treatment was a lot different. The second time I noticed that I started using the opioids to quash a different pain. The leg pain, the ankle pain, the hand pain, it was all gone. The lingering pain that I had from being retired, not knowing who I was, that loss of connection, the loss of team, my identity was gone, right? You think about that. Like when we leave the department, dude, those guys don't come with us. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We think we got this brotherhood. I mean, we were running guys down and all the stuff that I've gone through. I'm like, they're still my boys, but they weren't. And I'm not saying it was their fault. They had to go back to work. They were supporting their families. They had to go do the job. Whereas I went home, dude, and I just went through some massive depression. So what I'm telling you is the first time I took it, I had a different vibe. The second time, I was really trying to mask some internal pain. I hope that answers your question, brother.
It does. And I just wanted to just exploit just how dangerous and powerful this stuff is, because there's a lot of people out there that have never had to take it. And you see how quickly you can slip right into, you know, your circumstance. And I think the more people hear that, especially coming from somebody who's lived it, it's just important for anybody listening to know is it can be anybody, you know, super cop or, you know, Joe Blow. Nobody's immune to the power of, you know, the opioid and the pharmaceutical.
And I think I think that it is just like you just said, when it is presented or packaged a certain way, as if like I have heard. A heroin addict I had, I worked him for a while as an informant, and we, of course, you go out there, you do your buys and all this, but in the downtime you talk. I mean, most, you know, really good detectives, they talk to informants and you try to do everything you can to help them. And so it's like, he and I used to talk and he would explain, cause I'm like, how did all this start, man? And he's like, when I was about 15, we would grab, you know, pills and stuff from whoever we had, like mom, grandma, whoever. And we just like pop some pills. And their logic was at 15, this is made by the government, that this is okay. This isn't like heroin. This isn't, you know, coke or anything, or what, you know, this is something manufactured. And they're in their mind, it was the government making it, and that it's okay to take it because a parent or guardian or whomever the adult is taking it. So this guy starts popping these pills, and then they start figuring out, oh, these are oxys are the best. They like oxys, you know. So then he has to go out and start buying oxys for, you know, like the next year and a half. And he's breaking into everything he can, cars, homes, everything to feed that addiction. Then some really nice guy, so I mean, I'm being sarcastic, comes along and says, there's no way you can keep up $30 a pill. You can't steal enough to pay for that. I got this $10 bag right here that's going to get you just as high, but only costs $10 a bag. So then he starts mainlining heroin. I mean, like just straight in, boom, when he's like 17, blows his veins out. Cause he's hitting it so hard. By the time I encounter him, he's, you know, in his probably mid-20s, in late 20s, but he would talk about it. And then I won't go into all the other stuff, but what he was telling me, he's also conditioning and teaching me what people are going through and caught into that addiction. and then committing all these other crimes like the burglaries and stuff, or, you know, people are getting into frauds, but to feed that addiction. And then when heroin comes along, it's, you know, he's now buying it from another source. Right. And then that source introduces fentanyl, and then boom, you know, he can code out and die, or, you know, Narcan saves his life. But once Narcan or any type of agent like that saves someone from an overdose, then they chase that high. And then they're like, oh, I survived. You know, I got to get that fire. I got to get that's going to get me that high. Right.
Listen, this is crazy. I mean, you guys are in this and you understand fentanyl pills, $2 for a pill.
That's
crazy. So remember back in the day, these dudes are buying $20 bags. They're going through it. They're blowing through it. Today, a fentanyl pill is 60 times, at least in Arizona, when the labs are checking the toxicity, the strength of the fentanyl pills, it's about 60% now of fentanyl, right? Mm-hmm. The rest is all powder. It's whatever they throw, they smash into it. But 60% more than heroin. So when you start thinking about that, dude, the length of and strength of the high that you're getting from one pill versus a $20 bag, I mean, it's a freaking no-brainer.
And the average person doesn't understand how potent fentanyl is. I mean, you recover, you know, like, let's just say an ounce of fentanyl, they're bringing out the biohazard team to collect it. And then you have these users that are just, you know, throwing it in their pocket and taking it. And it's that. You know, an ounce of fentanyl will kill how many people?
Too many.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah,
it's insane.
Yeah. So, I mean, you have to look in the drug world too. So now, right now we're dealing with fentanyl. I mean, what's it going to be in the next 5 years?
They've already introduced carfentanil.
Mm-hmm.
So there's already three steps away from that. Carfentanil is 100 times more potent than heroin. Wow.
Yeah, so when you're talking about in Arizona too, the trends you're seeing there, we probably will see, if we haven't already, you know, down the line, like when meth first hit, you know, years ago, it was coming out of like Texas, it seemed like Oklahoma, maybe Arizona, you know, all down near the border. And then I can remember when meth was like slowly making its way out to the South. But the same thing, it's like we have to contact the agencies in the origins, you know, where it comes from. Like, hey, how are you dealing with it? How are you identifying it? You know, people were, you know, setting up meth labs and homes. And so we were able to go to training, you know, and you start bringing in people, you know, that work in different fields that spot the meth lab because of people buying Sudafed or, you know, liquid heat and all these ingredients. So it's like, we're still trying to learn too, like what's going on down near the border with fentanyl and who's plugged into it and how it's manufacture, like you're saying, like $2 pills. I haven't seen that yet out here or heard about it, I should say. But I have heard of people taking heroin and stamping it in the pill form because the feedback from the customers, the younger customers, didn't want to shoot it. You know what I mean? Like, it was almost like they want to get high, but they don't necessarily want to shoot it, but they package it in a pill. Boom, you take the pill, and maybe they charge $10 for a heroin pill too. Which is completely diabolical because they're taking it and trying to manufacture an easier way for someone to get high and then and be acceptable, so to speak.
Well, what's diabolical is the fact that these users are looking for the dealers that are causing their clients to overdose.
Yes.
So because they're like, that's what I want. That's the most important. That's the most potent. That's the best on the street. It's killing people. Let me go use it.
Yeah. What? Yeah. So I've had to explain in like briefings to people that's why you will see such a spike in lethal overdoses. Because as soon as someone finds out on the street they got a hot batch, it's like, let me get that person's number. Yeah, I got to get that. So now that person has a lethal overdose, and it's like the perfect commercial for heroin. But to the average citizen, that's the opposite logic. Like and even cops, like when I'm giving the briefings or we're talking or whatever, and they're like, well, that doesn't make sense. Especially like patrol officers who are going out to the overdoses, but maybe they don't get to encounter or have those conversations with drug users or dealers. And it's like, yeah. It's opposite day in that field. You know, they're chasing what is going to kill them. And, you know, sometimes now they're carrying those agents like Narcan or whatever that they can just spray up their nose and revive them. So it's not, and you know this too, it's like, depending on how severe their addiction is, death is not, that's not even always on their mind. You know what I mean? It's like, that's not part of the equation, which you have to kind of get over that too. So that's kind of the nice thing too, working in the drug world, that you don't see maybe like on a TV show or whatever, is the ability when people do recover and you run across that person a year or two down the road and you're like, damn, that's all right. They've recovered. Their life is good. You know, they got a job. Like, it makes you proud. Like, you want to hug them and stuff, you know, pat them on the back and be like, yeah, you know.
So yeah. Brock, we have listeners that are in law enforcement, and you've been a police officer and you've also been an addict. What advice would you give a police officer dealing with an addict?
Ooh, man, that's a dope. I love that question, man. Well, at least when I started in police department, I looked at dopers as the drugs of society. I didn't understand the chemical hook that dope does to people. Listen, this is what I would tell them. There is not one dope addict, one alcoholic that wants to live that lifestyle. Nobody does. But we can't stop it on our own. And I'm really being serious. I needed help, man. I needed some divine intervention to get off it. And it may be you. You may come up on that guy and you may just say the right thing and hit him at the right time where he's ready to recover. The problem is, in addiction, you have a small ass window to help people. You have a very small window. You know, you see all these intervention shows and stuff like that. They don't work. Because if I'm not ready, the pain that I got to go through to get to the other side, homie, it may not be worth it. When I detoxed, and I'm telling you, this is real. When I detoxed, I would rather you shoot me. I would rather be tasered and pepper sprayed 1,000 times than detox. It hurt so bad that I felt like I was going to throw up my bones. Like, it's the worst flu in the world. I crapped myself. I threw up on myself. I urinated myself. Like, I had nothing, dude. And I remember laying on the floor, dry heaving. And I'm thinking, God, if you don't take me, like, I'm going to throw up my back. Like, my bones are going to start shooting out my mouth. And that's real. Like, especially when it comes down to opioids, it is so scary to try to detox by yourself. And that's why that chase for the opioids, that chase, like, you're like, why are you so driven? Why do you need that high? Because your body starts craving it and it starts hurting. And just that moment of getting that in the body is like, okay, I got some peace now. If not, dude, it's just like angry. You're hurting so bad. So I would just tell the officer, man, be a little bit empathetic. Find out who this guy is, you know?
Go ahead. That's just such awesome advice. And I'm just reflecting on a mistake I made as a young officer and, you know, catching a guy in a B&E in progress. And I referred to him as a crackhead. And where I learned the lesson is he looked me right in the eyes and he said, man, why did you have to call me that? And that's when I realized I fucked up. And you know, it was a hard lesson to learn. And I'm embarrassed to tell that story, but I didn't know. You know, it's just you get hardened. You're young. You think you're, you know, Superman running around in a badge, and you almost forget that there's a human on the other end of your interaction. And that was a lesson learned, man. And that's why I asked that question. I think it's so important for not just law enforcement, but for anybody dealing with, you know, people with addiction. You hit the nail on the head. You didn't make that choice.
Yeah. So when you're talking about anybody dealing with addiction too, growing up and seeing it, like I would see it through relatives, and it was heartbreaking, but I didn't know necessarily what they were going through. And so my uncle went through it, and he was the one who kind of told me, like you said, he hit rock bottom he realized that his life could potentially end. And it wasn't heroin or fentanyl that he was on. His was alcohol. It started out with cocaine. It eventually became crack, which is how I started encountering him in my area when I was working. But for him, he had a facility that he went to that was completely operational by clinicians and recovering addicts were the staff. And so the recovering addicts could explain to him and everybody else, you start out phase one, you get nothing. Everybody's on an open cot in an open room. You're going to earn everything. And you can't like manipulate us with your sad story. Like, but we're here. We're here for you, whatever you need. It's a really cool program that we actually got to tour when we were patrol officers. So we would also understand then what people were going through in this facility. But that was the only, and he had tried everything else. So that was the only facility that worked for him. And he said, because at every step, you're earning your way. But you also have a place. If you follow the rules, you've got a place, you've got food, you've got support. And so for him, he finally got sober. And my grandmother's only wish was that he wouldn't die on the streets, because he was at the time he's, you know, off back and forth, you know. But that was her thing, was like, if my son doesn't die in the street, she'll be happy. And he ended up going to the VA because he had been in the military. They hooked him up with an apartment. He had some housing. He was in his late 50s, early 60s, and he ended up passing away in his sleep in the apartment. And I actually got the phone call from the officer when they had to make entry and told me, you know, that he had passed away. And that was the first thing I thought of, was one, he died sober, and that he died the way my grandmother wanted him to. Not that she wanted him to die, but hey, he's not going to be dead on the street. But he and I used to talk about addiction, and that was one of the things that he said, you don't want it. You don't want that type of lifestyle, but like you said, you're feeding that craving. And until you either reach that rock bottom, or you have that incident where someone steps in maybe and can help, or a program or whatever. But for us, I mean, that for most patrol officers, they don't always see that aspect, or like Ski just said, you make these mistakes. And the best part about what Ski just said, I thought anyway, what I took from it, is that guy looked Ski in the eyes and was like, why'd you have to call me that? Like, because that, you know, it's like you're reminding him of an addiction, or you're looking at him as less than a man. You know what I mean? So it's those, and probably if you want to get real deep, those uses of force that a lot of patrol officers are getting into with what people would say petty criminals or people who are breaking into cars, if they're feeding that addiction, they're also, one, not happy they're going to go to jail because now they're not going to get it fixed. But then two is all the encounter. Like if the officer does something like that, and I've made those mistakes too, I mean, a lot when I was a patrol officer, is that when you, that's where that escalates. And then the violence starts possibly because they're lashing out, not because you've done anything wrong other than them, you know, them feeling, you know, slighted or mistreated or looked down upon.
I got question, Brock. You said that you detoxed by yourself. Why did you decide to do it by yourself and not with the help of anybody? What brought you to the point where you said it's time for me to get sober? And why did you make the decision to do it on your own?
So my detox was 12 years ago, 12 and a half years ago. And there wasn't really detox centers. All I'd really ever heard, I mean, I didn't even know about AA. There were some church groups that I heard about that I went through for my pornography addiction, but I really didn't. And I also didn't know how deep I was. What happened to me was I woke up one morning and I went to the bathroom, opened up my cabinet, saw my pills, took a pill. And when I shut the cabinet, it gave me a glimpse into my life. And when I told you that in the life of an addict, you always have moments where you're like, I'm done. And that's where in law enforcement, man, if we can catch those guys and those women in that moment, oh man, you can do some big things. Unfortunately, when they're going to get dope, that's a hard moment because they're starting to hurt. So took the pill. And when I shut that, it shined in my room, and it automatically, there was a reflection that you, Brock, are living in a crack house. My room was it was terrible. It's horrible. And so I, A-type personality, got pissed off, ripped open the cabinet, grabbed all my pills and dumped them. And then there was that moment of, oh shit, you're in trouble. You just dumped all. If I could have scuba dived down those and pulled something out, I would have, man. But I realized, hey, you've been talking about this. And there was that moment where there was some clarity. I'm like, okay, Brock, you've talked about it. Now let's see if you're man enough to do it. And so I made the commitment to myself right then. I didn't want to alert anybody. I didn't want to tell anybody. I was willing to either do it or die. And so that was probably the biggest mistake I ever made in recovery. I did not know that for the next 7 days I was going to be in hell. So if there's one thing I can offer people who are listening, family members who are struggling, don't detox cold turkey. Don't throw the stuff out. Don't give them, don't tell them, hey, if you don't go to detox, we don't love you anymore. You're not in our family. That's not the way to do it. Allow them a little bit of grace and go to the hospital, take the medication and detox from it. And so that mine was a mistake. And I mean, I'm glad I had that mistake, but that's really what happened.
Well, and I think when you said type A personality, you already had a different type of personality where, like, for me thinking about like my uncle battling, when you said have that network and not cut people off, my grandmother and my dad and his siblings, they always supported him. You know what I mean? Like he would cycle, he would try to get sober. He would come and work and do construction, and he was bilingual. He spoke Spanish because my grandfather had been stationed in Spain. So he had learned Spanish at that time. So he had this skill that he was a really hard worker, but then, man, when we would call it falling off the wagon, you know, in the South, it's like, oh, he fell off the wagon, man. But the family always supported him. I mean, they had their problems, but it was never, like you said, like it wasn't, oh, well, we're just going to cut you off and you have to go to detox or to whatever. And I think that probably by having those supports, some people would say, oh, well, those were enablers, you know, but I never saw it that way because I got to actually experience hanging out with my uncle and seeing him on those months where he was not on the street. And then sadly, as I got older, I would see him, you know, going to punk rock shows and stuff. I would pass him panhandling and passed out. And sometimes he would be so drunk that he didn't know who I was. And so, I mean, that was always like heartbreaking to me. But then, you know, flash forward 6 months later, he would be at my grandmother's for, you know, Christmas dinner and stuff. And so we could just talk and laugh. And I could see that if someone can beat the addiction, this is what the prize is. You know, this guy is like one of the funniest guys I've ever met, nicest guy I ever met, and was actually helping a lot of people in this country work construction and navigate life because he was bilingual. So it just is, like you said, it was one of those things that by you telling us this, a lot of people may have that kind of hard heart or that, oh, a tough love. You just got to cut them off. And they're just going to have to realize it. And I mean, I don't know. I don't see a whole lot of success with that. I'm glad you said
there's not. If you think about it, Johann Hari said it best. He said the opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection. Mm. And so when you start thinking about it, I need people, man. When I left the department, I needed those guys. Like I performed at a high level because I had a team. Right. It wasn't always me. Mm-hmm. They elevated me. And so we are as good as we are association with, right? Like you guys are elevating because you have each other. Mm-hmm. And in addiction, the first thing we do is we cut each other off. I don't want you in my life. I don't want you to see this struggle. So our families get cut off. And instead of allowing them to cut you off, say, listen, I don't agree with your behaviors. I don't have to accept your behaviors, but I still love you. So what can I do to help you through it? And I'm going through it right now with the family member. I had to cut myself away from him because it was so toxic. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully when he is getting sober, I can have that relationship. But I want to just hit what you said really quick. You said about addiction, man, like those people who can overcome an addiction and stay sober and find long lasting recovery are the toughest people you will ever meet. And that is a real story. And people are like, well, why do they always talk about recovery? Because, man, it's like the biggest thing they've ever overcome, and they want to share that with other people.
You just segued into my next question for you, man. You went to the pits of hell, And you said you've been clean for 12 years now. Like, what did you learn about yourself through that process? Because obviously you've blossomed into just having a servant heart and just wanting to help people and everything. And so bring us to the, you know, you're clean from it now. And, you know, what does the clean 12 years look like? And what did that do to shape your life?
So it took a lot of time to reshape my relationship with my family, my kids. But my real family, my brothers and sisters, whatever. But my kids is what I had to fix at 5. And so I'm still, even today, dude, 12 years sober, I'm still making amends with them. I'm still fixing it. I went through a divorce. I cheated on their mom in active addiction. I just did a lot of stupid stuff, man, that I have to pay for. Everybody's like, well, you're sober now. Life's better. No, it's not. I'm still overcoming all the bull crap. So I would just tell people, man, stay the course. And my goal is, I talk about it all the time, because if I can help one dude not to go through that addiction, if they don't have to go through it, man, because it hurt my story, hey, that's a win, bro, because it took who I was, but it rebuilt me stronger. So if I could answer that question exactly, I felt super weak in active addiction. I hated my who I was. I hated myself because I'm like, damn, you can overcome this. But when I did overcome it, I'm like, man, you're a powerful son of a gun, dude. You know, and so it changes you. So hopefully that answered it.
Oh, that's amazing, man. And I can't imagine what it takes to do that, but it's so inspiring to just, and then the fact that you're willing to just sit and talk about it.
So, I'm interrupting you, but when you just said that about preventing someone, so like I said, that's why I didn't take any of those oxys when I got my surgery. And mainly also, or I shouldn't say mainly, but what I want to say is I also knew kind of growing up, like once I was in high school and in the Army, that I had this thing. I didn't know it was called an addictive personality, but I knew, man, when I like something, when I like the Army, I'm all in. You know what I mean? Like I'll freaking camo my teeth when I'm in the woods. Like I don't care, man. So I knew if I liked something, I wanted all of it. And I would see those same traits in people that were addicted. So here's a question, I guess. When you were younger, did you have that type of personality though, that where what some people may say an addictive personality or just something like that when you were younger? Like when I say like teenagers, like, you know, teenage age.
At 8 years old, dude, I remember my brother, he's older than me, 2 years older. We were taking out the trash, and when we opened the lid, there was hundreds of pornography magazines, porn Playboys back in the day. So if that dude would have kept those magazines today, he'd probably be a millionaire. But right, he threw out a stack of them, dude, like seriously. Mm-hmm. And I remember looking at it. I opened the first one up, and we talk about a chemical hook where you feel dopamine dumping. Have you guys ever jumped out of an airplane?
No, I've rappelled out of helicopters, but no.
Okay, so you get it. Like that moment where you're standing on the skiff and you're like, okay, dude, here we go. And it's like that moment you're falling. It's like, I don't know if I'm going to die, but this is hella cool. Right? It's the same. It was the same like thing that punched me in the face when I looked at pornography the first time. And I'm like, dude, I'm in trouble. I'm hooked. I remember going back in the house, my brother slapping the magazine out of my hand, saying, we don't look at that stuff. And I'm like thinking, I do. I didn't even know what it was, bro.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm back in the house, dude, and I could not let that go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I was like, dude, I was camouflaging my teeth trying to sneak my way back out there, dude.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I got back out, I hid two of the magazines, and then for the rest of the while, dude, I was going through reading everything and mm-hmm. look, I mean, so I absolutely did have that gene. Mm-hmm. And then when I left an apartment, I felt that hook again that made me feel better. It mm-hmm. felt like, okay, the more opioids I take, the better I feel. So yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And that, same thing here. So like when you did that, so that was your first sign, and I'm kind of getting personal, but did you get into like drinking alcohol in high school or mess around with weed or anything that people go, oh, well, I'm not addicted to drugs, but alcohol is different. It's like, no, it's still a drug. But did you mess around with any of that in high school?
I mean, I did smoke some weed, But the crazy part was my sex addiction from the pornography was what took over everything. Gotcha. Like my only goal in high school was to, it was crazy though. I never had sex. That's honest, but I did everything around it. I tried to, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so it became almost, a hindrance in my life, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But I didn't overcome addiction from pornography till I was 42. I'm 50 today. Mm-hmm. So I went from 8 to 42, if that tells you how long and how obsessive that addiction was. It was harder to overcome pornography than it was opioids.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah, way, dude. Oh, my gosh. Mm.
So then...
Because you think of it, it's a comfort thing, right? Mm-hmm. The cycle was the same. You're triggered. You have a craving. You masturbate. You feel better. Mm-hmm. Anytime you're stressed out, it was something that I could easily do and reduce my stress, because now I'm like, oh, dude, it just makes me feel better.
Okay.
And it was just an excuse, right?
And it's funny too, because you're in a profession, law enforcement, where you can get that dopamine rush every day. Like I had points in my career where I felt like I was just way over invested, not for the wrong reasons, but I couldn't get enough of it. It's that 3 a.m. phone call that says, hey, the car's moving. And now you're like, I'm not questioning whether I'm getting out of bed or not. Like, it's time to go to work. And then you're at work for 30 hours and you're not ready to go home. Right. And like, so that's cool that you got into a profession where that addictive personality is a good thing. Right. Did you ever,
it was like you, dude, I did that more than I loved my family.
Yeah. And no, it's right? Police work is just a beast of its own, but you're talking about those rushes and stuff. And I'm just kind of reflecting on some of the stuff I've gotten to do, and you can get addicted to it.
Yeah. Cold turkey. Stop it.
Right. Yeah. You get run over by a car and then it gets yanked from you.
Or like when you were talking about just in general, when you end up just like that, like you're on a unit, you're doing everything that you get to do. I always tell people, it's like the movies, like, you know, what we do, they make movies about whatever it is. If it's me, you know, homicide investigations, drug work, gang work, even patrol, like, you know, End of Watch is like a really great movie. And that's about patrol officers doing real stuff. And I recommend that movie to people. And sometimes people are like the Hollywood movie. I'm like, just check it out. And you'll see that when they made that movie, they were hitting all the key elements, but that's just two patrol officers that are motivated. And then they get right in the middle of something. But like Ski's saying, that idea of you get into that realm where it's just that cat and mouse game, and you're buying, you're chasing, you're doing all this stuff. And probably, I mean, I'm sure like y'all got tapped into other assignments too. Maybe it was just drugs, but other stuff like fugitive stuff or whatever, So just that whole idea. So then you start talking about, like, we get into right now, a lot of people now know the word human trafficking, right? Like that is the word now so for when we're talking about things and we're like, okay, yeah, there's this word going around, human trafficking. And for us, I say me, like Ski and I actually worked a special assignment when that word first started coming out, you know, and it was like, well, how are we dealing with this? And we were dealing with it with like low grade hotel surveillance. You know, we're in a van, we pull a couple of hard charging officers and we're like, we're going to need you to do takedowns, but we're going to do all the legwork of the surveillance and starting to interview people, because we were used to making prostitution arrests, right? And I think but before we got on the mic, you were telling a story, but this idea of, you know, what we knew as prostitution, it was like, oh, just go out there and arrest the female. And we never saw on the street level the organization until we did this project, and you start to see the hotels being used. But I did want to ask, like, down there, I know you've been out for a while, but like, is human trafficking still that's the buzzword down there, you know, with fentanyl as well? I mean, all kind of circles.
Yeah, man. I don't know if you've ever heard of Arizona Mills Mall, but Arizona Mills Mall is like the number one place in the U.S. for human trafficking. And that's about 15 minutes from my house.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, because you have 3 feet freeways right there, like within 5 seconds, you can be on a freeway and be gone. You can hit California, you can hit Mexico. I mean, wherever you want to go, you're out.
Yeah. So one of those things that we're just looking at a dry erase board and Jimmy wrote up there some stuff, and it's starting to kind of make sense. Like, you've got pornography and you've got the drug industry, which basically could equal the sex trade, or at least those two, you know, those two elements that are all kind of circling that are mainstream. You know, pornography is mainstream. Taking OxyContin is mainstream. We've got this huge, you know, increase in sex trade or human trafficking. And that's the thing too, like for a lot of people out there, for patrol officers who don't get to experience, when you're working a prostitution project or you're working human trafficking, you start seeing the Johns, as they call them, you know, the customers from every different kind of background. Yeah. Mm.
I wanted to add the reason I wrote this, and I appreciate you guys giving me the second to speak my mind, is that I think when I look at the three, I look at pornography, I look at the sex trade, I look at drug industry, and I look at them all as being perpetuated through addiction. That without somebody's addiction to one of these three deviants, none of them exist. So there's each one of these industries. The drug industry could be underground, black market, whatever you want to call it, or it could be actual fentanyl you get from your doctor or opioids. I am the one in the 1 in 3 people in this room who've had that problem. So sex trade, people selling sex, whether it's themselves, they're, you know, willfully selling their own body, or there's minority trading, and then pornography, all the things that go on of that, the need for pornography, like you're talking about yourself, and the way that these, you know, these, the sex trade within pornography is fueled by drugs. And it all is just this nasty maelstrom of addiction and human suffering. And I that's why hearing you guys say that, that's just kind of what was popping in my head. That's why I wanted to write what I did.
But you also got to think there's two other things that we're missing: guns and money. Mm-hmm. So if you start following the trade in Arizona, I've kind of been following it. If you look at all the fentanyl arrests, they always have fentanyl, guns, and money on them, and a lot of it. Mm-hmm. Right? So you think about that, man, you're like, why guns? Well, they're protecting mm-hmm. Monies, and the cartel's pretty smart about this. They try not to get too much into addiction. Mm-hmm. Right? Because you don't want to eat your product up, man. So they're selling so much of it. And but yeah, add that to your whiteboard, man, because that's a good thing to also follow along with the pornographies, the guns, and the money.
Yeah, we're seeing, and this is, I can guarantee you, any state in the U.S. right now, if you were pulling statistics, or anyone who's working the street, for the listeners who are officers or agents or deputies, you're seeing a huge increase in firearms, period, in the criminal underworld. Drug dealers, gang members, cartels, you know, people who are pimping girls, everybody's got a gun. And it's to the point now where officers are stopping cars, and inside of the car, there may be three people, and you'll have three people, guns in their waistband or under the leg or under the seat, like readily available. And then there'll be a friggin' rifle, you know, a chopped down Draco or something in the back seat under a jacket, ready to go. No one really, I don't want to say no one, I don't want to generalize. Most of the criminal element out there that are dealing in those trades are strapped now, and they're not fearing officers stopping them or getting arrested or getting adopted into ATF federal gun charges. So, and the reason I say that is we know that we know from talking to people that is the vibe on the street, because there's less proactive policing. There's less of a push to disrupt that type of activity. So, and you're on the front lines down there. I mean, our next wave in the South, and it's already here, is cartels. So the next evolution of criminal, I mean, when you you study criminal organizations, and you go back to, you know, you can go back to Shanghai and the Green Gang. You can go to Chicago and Capone and the mobsters. You can go to the 70s and the 80s, the rise of street gangs in LA and Chicago. Cartels are next. I mean, that's just the next wave of this activity.
Yeah, dude, can buckle up. Yeah, that's all I'm saying. And the problem is there's so much money in it, right? And people right now need money. And they're so motivated to do it. And a lot of the people that we're arresting in Arizona are they're really not even involved, dude. They're just mules. Mm-hmm. They're just in it to transport the dope to hopefully not get pulled over and get it to A to B. Because the cartel, I mean, you have these people that are so willing to leave Mexico to do it mm-hmm. that they're keeping clean from it.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Brock, I read a really cool story that you were quoted in, and I love stories like this, and I think you vividly described the presence of the Holy Spirit. You know what I'm referring to?
No, man, help me out.
Yeah, you were talking about, I believe you were involved in a shooting.
Okay.
And you were talking about just the calmness and the Holy Spirit, and you referred to the parable of the sheep. Matthew 18:12, talking about the 99 and the one and never being left behind. You know what I'm referring to?
I remember talking about it, but is there something specific? Remind me.
No, it was an involved incident that you were involved in. I don't know if you want to talk about it or not. I just
let's talk about it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're talking about the actual pinpoint when I actually shot.
Yeah, and that's what I was reading, and that's like some of the stuff I was reading was just really cool how time slowed down and
oh yeah,
man, that's something like you're willing to get into.
Yeah, so this was December 27th, man, 2001. Wade Jordan was the suspect. He's deceased now. Bless his heart. Made a bad decision. This would have been his fourth or fifth DUI. Patrol gets behind him. He refuses to stop. Long story short, he gets caught in a cul-de-sac. Can't get out. And what was interesting was, I don't know how you guys carry your ARs, but we had to carry ours in the trunk. We call it a patrol ready, which is, in law enforcement, it's not always the smartest people making policy.
No.
But as I'm driving, I hear God talk to me or whatever voice it was saying, hey, you're going to be in a shooting tonight. Pull over, get your weapon ready. It's like, whatever. You know, that's too clean. So I'm driving down the road again, and I hear it again, dude, stop. Load your weapon. And I'm like, all right, two times. So I pull over, grab my weapon, load it, put it in the center console, you know, put it right there in the middle where we used to carry the shotguns and the clamps. And I'm driving, I'm paralleling it. Man, I'm not even supposed to be in this. The guy starts coming my way. He pulls in the cul-de-sac. I'm number one in there. I get to the middle. We fan out. We felony stop him. I open the door. I'm in the doorway. And the situation starts, man. I wish today we would have recorded it because we did everything right. Like we pepper sprayed him, verbal commands, hard hands, beanbagged him, canine bit him. And nothing. This dude was just resilient, man. He was so drunk, so high that we had no effect on him. But I remember, man, when he gets back in his truck, I could see him grab the column and go to shift it. And time actually like slowed way down. And when I pulled the trigger, I saw the round come out of my barrel and I saw it spinning and I saw the flume of smoke just going. You know, it was so surreal, man. I saw the round travel the whole time and just spinning, bam, boom, spinning. And then when it hit the windshield like had this like little slow down crack and I could see it just shattering. And then I saw it made a hole and then the round came through and hit him right in the chin. Wow. Okay. So right over the steering wheel, right into the chin. And then I shot a follow up and it caught him right under the collarbone. And it was just, it was weird because he leaned back, raised his arm, and then put his arm down. And I thought the shooting's over. And then, you know, that sympathetic reflex raised his arm. And then it was like another barrage of rounds went into him. And so we took his life, you know. And that was kind of one of my first experiences. When I left there, I'm like, damn, this is 2 days after Christmas. How did he get to the point to where 2 days after Christmas, he was so distraught that he wanted to take his own life or have an officer take his life? And the hard part was a couple months after that, the deposition started and I'm in a room with his mom, dad, and sister. And the deposition was over And his mom's like, Officer Bevel, can I ask you one question? And I'm like, my attorney's like, you don't have to answer this. Maybe it's probably a better idea that you don't. But she's a mom, right? And I want to be able to be on her level, and I want to talk to her. And she says, Officer Bevel, if you had a chance to do it again, would you kill my son? Oof, man, that's a tough conversation to have, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at her face to face, and I'm thinking, man, you could be super coy here. You could be a total douchebag, but tell her the truth. And I said, I wish I didn't have to kill your son. That was a hard decision. But he gave me no choice, and my training kicked in. And when he drove his vehicle to try to run us over and kill us, I had to protect my people, and I had to take his life. So if the role were reversed 1,000 times, I would have done the same thing. Mm. And so she understood it. She understood at least my point of view. Didn't mean that she accepted it, but at least she got to see where I was coming from. And so there was a little bit of healing in that. And so, yeah, you never want to do that. You never want to have to take someone's life. But as an officer, and to be honest, even to back up, I don't know if you guys had this thought. When you're training so much, right, you're going through all these quals and you're changing weapons, and you get to a point, you're like, man, if I ever get in a shooting, will I hit? I don't know if you guys, but I was always concerned, like, Am I gonna be that guy that freaks out? Am I gonna throw rounds over the dude's head? Am I gonna be able to do my job? And so in reality, and I hope it doesn't sound out of line, but I was almost thankful that event happened to be able to soothe my mind a little bit, saying, okay, you've been here, you've done it, you hit your target, you did your training, did what it was supposed to do. Mm-hmm. So I don't know where you guys are at on that, if you ever think like that, but man.
No, I think one of the most important things you said in all that is when you chose to answer the mom and you did not want to kill him. And
no,
man, that just speaks powers. It's just so powerful to hear, especially with just modern, you know, day media coverage on law enforcement and everything. And, you know, That's the truth behind it. It's like there's not anybody that's putting a badge and a gun on every day that wants to go and take a life.
Well, and I think just like you said, there was no other choice. At that point, we are always reacting to people's actions. So when people continue those actions and you've tried everything, that's the last option. And nobody wants to go through that. And nobody, like you said, though, when you train, you have to feel confident that if that day comes, that you can do what you're trained to do. Because if you don't, a third person or another person could potentially die or lose limb or get injured, or it could be you, or it could be other officers or a small child. And most people don't put themselves in the position of the officer. And I do hope moving forward and in America that people start to do that and start to understand there's a human being in a uniform that is, or in plain clothes, but there's a human being that has to step in and stop another human being from causing death or bodily injury to another human being. And we're doing the best we can, and we're hoping that our training will suffice, and we're always trying to get better training. We're always trying to do better things. And now, I mean, Ski and I were having the talk earlier today about tourniquets and medical training and how now, I mean, we have officers in general in law enforcement that are involved in shootings, and now they're switching, they're having to switch gears as soon as they shoot somebody, and officers are having to put tourniquets on and try to stop the bleeding because now the threat has stopped and the person is down. And for a lot of citizens, when they find that out, they're like, oh, I never thought of that. It's like, you're asking human beings to switch gears rapidly between acts of violence and then acts of saving lives. And it's the life of the person sometimes that was actually causing the threat, you know? So I am glad that you spoke on that, because for a lot of people to understand the things that you've kind of been through and the ups and downs, and that you've been there and done those types of assignments and the things that did happen to you. I mean, it's been good to be able to talk about a lot of that. And we even say on the show that there are people that we want to have, like to come back as guests, and to be able to talk about things and to get into, like, you know, your perspective on other things. So it's one of those things that don't worry. We're going to be having you back on, you know, in the future, man. And having you as a future guest, because like I said, you and I have great conversations. It's like tonight, or, you know, tonight we want to talk about a lot of the stuff in your life. And then, you know, future episodes, we may get some feedback and people say, hey, I want to hear more about this, about him or his perspective on this, because you've got that great perspective. So I really appreciate that, man.
Love it, man. Anytime, man. I'm honored.
Yeah. So any other questions you've got? Jimmy Orski?
Yeah, just the chase the vase. What's the vibe on it? I mean, what are you going for on that?
So right on, man. Chase the Vase comes from a World War I story of a guy named William Peck. And I'm going to challenge you to go check it out, but I'll give you basically the bottom line. The vase is something we're all chasing. In my life, for the longest time, it was sobriety. It was a good marriage. It was financial freedom. And when you get that vase, now what? What are you going to do with this vase? You're just going to put it on your shelf? Or are you going to keep building it and grow to the next one and chasing it? And so for us, if I find sobriety and just put my vase on the shelf, I'm not doing humanity any good. So my goal is, my next vase is to pass it on to somebody else to help them find sobriety and help them find recovery.
Man, that is so cool.
The vase is you, man. It's what you're chasing.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So how can people find you out there?
Man, just go to my name, Brock Double, or Chase the Vase. Man, we are doing something cool. We're putting a concert together July 14th here in Mesa. And everybody's like, dude, what are you doing about recovery? Everybody's trying to do it. We're trying to connect people with people. And so we invited a guy named Ben Fuller. He's a country artist, Christian artist from Nashville. He's coming. He's got a recovery story, recovering heroin, cocaine addict, dude. And we're throwing a concert. So if you guys want to show up in Arizona, come on, man.
You don't have to ask twice.
It's in July. We're just trying to put this off. We're trying to show people that we can recover. Here we go. It's going to be out loud. Let's just go. So that's it, man.
That's really cool. And you're promoting the concert. It's something you're working on putting together?
Dude, it's mine, man. It's mine and this lady from Idaho. She put one on in Idaho. I said, let's do it in Arizona. Let's do it in Mississippi. I don't care where we do it. We just want to invite people to see that recovery is possible.
And then are you looking for more artists? Because I have a dude also out of Tennessee area who is a recovering addict. He does Christian music. We might have to put him on your bill, man, and just come down.
Hey. Let's go, dude. Anybody that's on it, let's go. Sign them up.
I'm going to encourage you to look up a guy named Mike Ferris.
Okay.
You will not be disappointed. I mean, he literally fits the bill for what you're talking about. He does
F-E-R-R-I-S.
F-A-R-R-I-S. And he does some really cool. He does a good testimony. He tells some stories. And it's the same thing, man. But yeah, very cool stuff. Let's go, man. Are you a big music guy?
Love it.
All right. We love getting into music, man. So what's your favorite style of music, or what are you listening to these days?
Man, I'm a fan of NF. I love NF. Mm-hmm. If I'm going old school, favorite band is U2. They it's like going to church, bro. I don't know why. Yeah. I absolutely dig Christian music, but I'm a Metallica guy too.
Either way, bro. Hold on, man. Can you say it?
Oh, come on, man. I gotcha.
Oh yeah. That's so cool, man. And NF, he's the rapper, right?
Yeah.
He's awesome. I literally, like, 3 weeks ago, I got in on Spotify and somebody had said, "Hey, listen to this guy, dude. He can tell a story."
Woo,
yeah. Oh, it's amazing.
His album.
Dude, he's amazing. No, that's really cool. Really cool.
Any new bands, if you could say, hey, you know what? These people are new. Check them out. Give them a shot. Who would it be?
Man, I don't,
if you have anybody. It's tough. I know.
New band. I don't, dude, I would throw out a band. You're like, yeah, they're like 6 years old, homie. I don't, I don't know, man.
Or how about an obscure band maybe that you think that not everybody's heard of, maybe, you know, like maybe not like as big as U2 or something.
Oh man.
Look at that. Man. Brock is at a loss for words, man.
Dude, I don't know.
Never thought that would happen, but I like it. That's all right.
Well, old school, I love a guy named Michael W. Smith. He's just, he kind of like turned me on to Christian music back in the day.
So they never
not very popular anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But so here, and what's weird is I love heavy metal, dude, but I infiltrated my brain with so much negativity and darkness.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm like, seriously, today I want to throw as much light in my life as I possibly can.
That's so awesome.
I throw on like Pantera, dude. I want to go kick in, you know what I mean? Kicking something in, dude.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I got to like offset that a little bit. And so Christian music's kind of been my jam lately.
Dude, I have a band for you, man. It's the catch all. They are a Christian. Fit for a King.
Oh, I love them.
Yes, there you go. There's your fix, man. Christian metal, when you read those lyrics, though, and their breakdowns, and dude, the lead singer of that band is just amazing.
Got it.
Go. I got one better for you.
Creed.
See, like,
well, we're talking about mental health and drug use, so I figured why not throw some Scott Stapp in there?
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying, man. Right on.
So then. So everybody right you're saying needs to go out and check. You said Michael W. Smith, and then
I wouldn't send you there.
I'm not saying everybody. I should say people that you said that want a little bit of inspiration. Check that.
He's kind of you asked me to throw back way back.
But the reason I say that is like, I mean, we talk about it, and then and people will message us and be like, oh man, y'all mentioned this band or that band, I forgot about them. Or I mean, I mentioned Turnstile. Unlike our intro, and people were texting me like, or sending me messages like, oh, I'm already listening to Turnstile, man. I never heard of this band. But so that's the only reason we asked that. It doesn't have to be, I mean, not for everybody, but I like it.
So check out Ben Fuller. He's the guy that's coming to Arizona. I found him. It's not like, I mean, I didn't create him or find him, but I found him through the music. And I just, he's got a couple songs that are just super dope. And then a guy named Cody Carnes. I don't know if you know him.
Mm-mm.
So yeah, check it out, man.
Very cool. What's the name of the concert?
It's called Connection is the Cure.
Connection is the Cure. And that's in your where you're at in Arizona, Mesa.
It's July 14th, man. We're trying to fill its 2,000 capacity. And
man, I hope there's a line out the
it's
door.
It's a free concert, dude. It's a free concert. How we're cool just trying to like bring people in and say, man, look at us. You can do this,
man. We're meant to do life together, man. So I love the reference to just being a light in a dark world and just bringing people together, and like that's what it's all about, man.
Let's go.
Hey, Brock, send us as much of that info as you can, and we'll use
absolutely
whatever platform we love to help you with.
Hey, why don't you guys just show up?
That's what I'm saying. And when you go on tour, you're just gonna have to come to the South too, man.
Hey,
let's get this show on the road.
Mississippi, let's go.
I love it.
All right.
But to end it like this, man, everybody talks about doing big things. Everybody wants to make that big change in life. Here's the invitation. Stop talking about it. Right? Just like you guys, man, you have a platform. It's not easy to record podcasts. It's not easy to get them out there. So everybody's like, oh, I can do a podcast. Then do it. Right? I could be a cop. Then do it. But just like, if we want to recover, man, you got to just do it. Stop talking about it. And that's why we're doing this concert. It was like, oh, you can't do a recovery concert. Watch us.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the invitation. Just freaking chase that bass, man.
Man, I love it.
I love it. Let's end it on that, man.
Right
on. That's outstanding, Brock. Disruptors out.